Hi, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Vijay Prashad, who teaches South Asian history at Trinity College in Connecticut, on the overwhelming victory of the Congress Party in the recent Indian elections. A surprise to almost everyone, but what does it mean? And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with David Skeel, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Law School, on how we might use the bankruptcy code to handle financial crises instead of throwing trillions at failing institutions. A little geeky, perhaps, but every now and then it pays to dive into the arcane. Before all that, some words in the economic news, mostly a mixed bag over the last week. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, filed by those who've just lost their jobs, fell by 12,000 last week, but the count of those continuing to draw benefits, which comes with a week's delay, rose by 75,000. This continues the pattern we've been seeing recently, which suggests that the pace of job loss continues to slow, but hiring has yet to pick up. That impression was confirmed by some longer-term data. It's not often appreciated how the monthly job gain or loss figures are merely the rather placid-seeming surface of a very turbulent underlying reality. That is, the monthly gain or loss of a few hundred thousand jobs is the product of millions of gross job gains and losses. The Bureau of Labor Statistics surveys this situation every quarter. Early in the week, we learned that in the third quarter of the year, there were 6.8 million new jobs created and about 7.7 million destroyed, for a net loss of over 900,000. That net loss was the product of over 14 million gross gains and losses, a furious pace of turnover, though actually rather modest by historical standards. Although there was little change from the previous quarter in the number of jobs destroyed, there was a 400,000 decrease in the number created. It's reassuring that the rate of job loss didn't accelerate, but the rate of hiring has to pick up if the job market is ever going to recover. Leading indexes, indicators that have a pretty good record in calling turns in the economy 3 to 6 months out, continue to report some cheering news. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly index rose last week for the fifth consecutive week, and it's now 3% higher than where it was 6 months ago. That may not sound like much, but we haven't seen anything that good in almost 3 years. The less sensitive, though still highly respectable, monthly leading index from the Conference Board rose 1% from March to April, its best showing since the economy took a turn for the worse last fall. So this gives us reason to hope that not only has the economic slide slowed down, but we might even start seeing some positive numbers in the fall. A money manager from BlackRock was quoted by Bloomberg, the financial wire service, not New York City's mayor, the other day saying that we need good numbers as opposed to less bad numbers. Exactly. We've been getting the less bad. Let's hope some better ones are on the way. That aside, I'm sticking to my prediction that the job market will be the last to get the good news, should we start seeing some of that in a few months. My guess is that the unemployment rate will top out slightly north of 10%, and we're going to lose something like another 2 million jobs before this erosion is all over. Then the job market will start turning around, but very slowly, very slowly. Speaking of BlackRock, as I did just moments ago, all the government's efforts to rescue the financial system still have a bad odor about them. There's the problem that I pointed to many times, that the government has hired advisors like BlackRock on how to handle toxic assets, at the same time that firms like BlackRock and their clients own very similar toxic assets. The polite way that the New York Times, which I feel a little guilty about making fun of, giving its dwindling life expectancy, the polite way the Times would deal with this would be to describe this relationship as raising questions. But it really doesn't raise questions. It screams profound conflict of interest. But if there's ever doubt about the class nature of the state, especially its executive branch, moments like these clarify things immensely. No, the relationship doesn't raise questions. It answers them, if anyone's asking. But we've been here before. In the realm of newer news, it's looking like the FDIC is selling off banks to the usual gang of sharpies at fire sale prices. And in what follows, I should say I'm drawing on a piece by Robert Siren on the financial website breakingviews.com. One problem is that the FDIC is severely underfinanced and overworked. It's being called on to fund high-profile bailouts of brand-name banks, as well as more routine rescues of institutions that no one within a 50-mile radius of their headquarters is likely to have heard of. An example of the first, the high-profile sort, was the January sale of IndyMac to a consortium of private equity, or PE, firms. And in this example of the second, it's now selling Florida's Bank United to a PE syndicate, including such stars of the field as Wilbur Ross, Carlyle Group, Blackstone, and Centerbridge. A quick parenthetical definition of private equity. PE funds are large pools of capital contributed by big institutions and rich individuals, devoted mainly to taking over other companies, cutting their costs, taking out as much cash as they can get away with from the company, and selling the firms on to someone else, like another company or public stock investors. The managers of PE firms make lots of money for themselves. It's not clear how much they make for their outside investors. Back to the FDIC. The terms of the Bank United sale are very favorable to the PE firms. They'll get almost $13 billion in troubled assets for just $900 million. And the FDIC will assume almost $5 billion in the bank's losses. Most of the bank's assets are in wretched subprime loans in Florida, some of the most toxic assets of all. Still, it looks like the PE guys are buying the assets for less than 30 cents to the dollar, with not all that much downside risk. Yes, the FDIC is very short of funds, and it has to be creative. But really, this is not the way to turn the page on the Second Gilded Age. It's to write a new chapter, in a different style from what went before, but with the narrative still distinctly recognizable. And there's more. A Bloomberg analysis, again the news service, not the billionaire mayor, shows that the banks that are looking to buy their way out of the Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP, so they can get out from under those onerous pay restrictions and all that public scrutiny, may do so at very favorable prices, if the first such transaction is any kind of precedent. When the government provided the TARP funds, it did so by buying warrants on the banks. Warrants are rights to buy stock at some time in the future. If the stock's price rises, the government could make some money, as the value of the warrants rose in tandem. But warrants grant no voting rights, which is what the government wanted. Fear of nationalization, you know. To get out of the TARP, the banks have to buy back that stock with the approval of the Treasury. Old National Bancorp, an Indiana institution, is the first to exit the program. It gave the Treasury $1.2 million to buy back its stock. Private analyses suggest that the price should have been about five times higher, based on standard first-year MBA financial formulas. If that sort of pricing prevails for other banks interested in freeing themselves of the man, the Gov will be shortchanged by about $10 billion, according to Bloomberg. That would give the banks about 80% of the profits the Treasury could have claimed, should this kind of pricing be a model. There's no reason for this at all, except kindness to the banks. None. Raises questions, eh? Okay, let's take a musical break. Some of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, written in memory of the Nazi siege of Leningrad, performed by the Chicago Symphony under Leonard Bernstein. It's a pretty corny work, far from his best stuff, but it was immensely popular during World War II. That particular passage is an excerpt from a long section of the first movement, which consists of ever more bombastic repetitions of that simple theme. We'll hear what an annoyed Béla Bartók did with that in about 20 minutes. My first guest is Vijay Prashad, who teaches South Asian history at Trinity College in Connecticut. India's recent elections produced a stunning landslide, expected by almost no one, for the Congress Party, a party that was once almost synonymous with the Indian government, but then fell on harder times. Now Congress is back on top of the world. Let's hear what it all means from Vijay Prashad. So a massive victory for the Congress Party in India surprised just about everyone by the scale of it, and pretty high turnout too, right? What's your impression? What does it mean?
This is an extraordinary election. We have registered voters. About 700 million people can vote in India. About 440 million people came and voted. It went on for over a month. The scale, it's unimaginable the scale that the state had to, put up to conduct this vote. So all that, being said, this was an amazing election. I have never seen an election where the result was so unexpected. In all previous elections, one had a sense of where the electorate was going to go. This was not foreseeable. And, you know, the Congress came out with what, by all indications, is not just an enormous victory, but they have really sent the political scientists back to the laboratory, because people had been saying for years that the age of a single party, particularly the Congress, being able to win a lion's share of the seats was over. The Nehru era was gone. We were now in the age of coalition politics, you know, something resembling Italy and Israel, and this was to be the way forward. This election has demonstrated that the Congress is back. The Congress is only 11 seats short of a majority in a 543-seat House. So, you know, they can pretty much govern from their position. So it's an extraordinary election for many reasons.
All right, let's give us the capsule radio history of Congress. It goes way back in Indian history, right?
Well, the Congress Party was founded in 1885, interestingly, by an Englishman and a group of Indians. They believed that people who were being held back from advancement in the Indian civil service, the imperial civil service, should get more opportunities. Indians should have a say in their governance, not independence from British rule, but just an advisory say. That was the foundation of the Congress in 1885. From 1885 to the 1910s, the Congress met every year. They passed resolutions asking for more rights, and nothing came of it. In the 1910s, Mahatma Gandhi will make the Congress into a mass party, an anti-colonial party. They enunciate the demand for complete independence, and they start mass demonstrations. This is the first time the Congress becomes a party of the masses. Well, certainly they build up an enormous cachet among the people. The people see them as the instrument of deliverance. In 1947, when India wins independence, the Congress is by far the largest political representative of the Indian people. At the first general election in 1952, the Congress sweeps the country and continues to sweep the country till about the late 1960s, till 1967. From 67 onwards, we begin to see the emergence of regional political parties, parties that have commitments to a kind of linguistic nationalism. You know, India is a country with almost 300 languages, 28 of them recognized by the central government. So there are linguistic national parties, regional business elites form their own party. So after 1967, the Congress begins to lose that overwhelming sense of being the representative of the Indian people. Up to the 1990s, the Congress continued to be committed to both secularism, equality of all religions, and committed to a form of socialism, Fabian socialism, up to the 1990s. And this was really what gave the Congress its platform, its plank. In 1991, the Congress Party moved to what is called in India liberalization. That is to say, this process of what is also called economic reform. So when the Congress went in that direction, it really lost a lot of its mass character and became quite clear that the Congress would not be able to recover the ground if it didn't change this. To say this very quickly, the right wing, the party of political Hinduism, picked up where the Congress was losing, and they formed a government in the mid-1990s, a largely unpopular government. The Congress returned to power in 2004 in alliance with the left, and as a result, to my mind, of that alliance, the Congress rediscovered some of its social democratic values and principles and put those into effect. And very lucky for the Congress, while their people wanted to continue these so-called economic reforms, particularly in the world of finance and current account convertibility, opening the rupee to of the forces of finance, The left blocked all that, and that has protected the Indian state and economy from the current financial crisis. So the Congress's return in many ways, is a return also of its social democratic roots.
But the left itself got hammered in this election, right?
The left took a beating, and the left took a beating on several counts. One, there is a peril of entering governance where you are just, with a few things on your agenda, law and order, education, health, etc., but where you don't control the constitutional question. So there is always a peril of entering governance where the agenda is going to be narrowed. Well, when the left took power in Bengal in 1977, they never assumed that they were going to last in governance more than, a few years. But they have been in power for 32 years. And in the mid-1980s, the left decided if they were going to remain in government, then they have to start providing the wide range of, services and things like that for the population. Well, they conducted a rigorous campaign of agricultural democracy in the 1970s and 80s, and that gained them in a very considerable vote bank, as it were, among small peasants and middle peasants. Well, as they've, come to the point where Bengal has the highest agricultural growth rate, increasingly they have an enormous unemployment problem. Well, the classical way to approach this is then to industrialize. I mean, that's like by the book thinking. So the left then moved to industrialization. Now, as they did this in the 1980s onwards, they began to sit on an untamed animal in a way, because the very forces that they had unleashed to create agrarian democracy were people now not willing to do things like give up land for industry or to move to industry. So this really has been the process that the so-called industrialization policy, land acquisition things, these were the agenda. So the right wing...
But they became the agents of primitive accumulation, to use the old language, right?
Yes, to some extent, although not exactly that. I mean, it's a little complicated. In the region of Hooghly, where a Tata car factory was to be built, the left said, we are not going to allow the Tata company to buy land directly from small landholders, because it will be a very corrupt system. We will buy the land and give high compensation. But what happens then when some people, say 30%, say we don't want to alienate, give up our land? You are in a problem. I mean, so in that sense, yes, the left became agents of land acquisition, even when they were within the terms of the Constitution providing a very decent, remuneration. What happens when people, even at higher rates of remuneration, are unwilling to give up land? This is where we come to questions of, is it eminent domain? Are there larger interests such as unemployment at stake and things? But the left, one of the real failings here was didn't politicize the issue. They didn't take the issue to the people and say, in each of your families there are two unemployed people. Where do we find employment for them? What are alternatives to employment? So this was not taken to the people. They tried to administer this, and I think that was what the electorate punished the left with.
I'm speaking with Bijay Prashad, who is a professor of South Asian history at Trinity College. Congress, though, is also very much identified with neoliberalism, although with a bit of social democratic cushioning, yet they were not punished for this electorally, quite the contrary. Does this mean that neoliberalism has got some roots with the Indian people?
It's complicated. It's that in Bengal, the parties of the right took up the land acquisition issue and hit the left with it very hard. And the media went along saying, you are hypocrites, because on the one hand, you're against forcible seizure, and on the other hand, you seem to be doing it. So everything was poised against the left in Bengal. In the rest of the country, where parties that had been doing similar things and worse, also had no opposition that was capable of picking up the standard and saying, you are doing land acquisition. In other words, in states like Rajasthan, in states like Uttar Pradesh, where land acquisition is routine, there is no opposition to the parties. All the parties have been conniving in the same policies. So that was one problem that the left faced in Bengal and others didn't face. Secondly, the Congress enthusiastically picked up a demand that the left had been making since the 1990s, which is to give agricultural workers a guaranteed 100-day work. So the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, which was passed in 2005, guaranteed that in every household, at least one adult would be given 100 days of work and wages at the minimum level. So this was a great, you know, very popular measure. The Congress was able, they made this their campaign platform. And in a country where, you know, in the last 6 months, 660,000 people have lost their jobs, this is an incredibly powerful platform. The only comparable thing is the township village enterprise remnants that are there in China, where people fired can at least make some claim on a rice bowl. This is what it resembled. And the Congress ran on it, you know, with a great deal of enthusiasm. And I must say, they played electorally a very smart game.
Now, if there's a bit of good news out of this election, is that the Hindu nationalists, the BJP, got hammered as well as the left. What happened to them?
They have been in a process of withdrawal for quite a while. They won 117 seats, so they were not defeated to zero. They still command a section of the vote. They have a problem, which is that they have no economic plank at all. In fact, in this election, all they could talk about was Swiss bank accounts. You know, they couldn't talk about any of their other economic positions because they have none. So there's that. Secondly, on the question of where they are strong, which is on ideas like national security and such, the Congress had played such a clever game, that is not the Congress, but this administration, during and after the Mumbai attacks in 2008. You see, the media and the Party of Political Hinduism were trying to get the government to attack Pakistan, to do some kind of, you know, symbolic raid or something against the Lashkar-e-Taiba's headquarters. But this government decided not to go in that route. And it said that the way forward has to be a police investigation, diplomatic channels, etc. So the soberness of its response took Mumbai off the table. I mean, we had thought right after that attack that the BJP would carry the Mumbai attack, you know, on its platform. That would be the centerpiece. But the Congress very cannily removed it from consideration because they demonstrated the advantage of a sober approach to foreign policy. And on the point of the Hindu rights principle plank, which is anti-Muslim sentiment, unfortunately for the BJP, one of its candidates went out and made some rather ghastly statements about, violence against Muslims. And he came off looking so bad, so gauche and almost juvenile in his, hatred, that it really made the party run backwards away from those statements and therefore annoy their base. And so in many ways, this has been an advantage for everybody else that the BJP is in an unresolvable contradiction. There's one issue that's also there, which is I'd mentioned foreign policy and I'd mentioned Pakistan. As well, India has been in this nuclear deal with the United States. You know, that opposition to that deal played very well when George Bush was in power, because there was no better face for aggressive American imperialism than George Bush. With Obama's ascension, things have become complicated, because now it's very hard to make the argument about abstract American imperialism when there is somebody as personable as Obama with his finger 3 inches from a nuclear launch button. Nobody believes you. And it has become very complicated. And I'll give you that at the Iranian elections, which will come in June, a similar problem is going to be there. The Obama factor is going to play havoc with forces that will try to lift the banner of anti-imperialism.
Yes, Obama's a great great plus for American imperialism, isn't he? What about the increasing instability in Pakistan and the apparent rise of the Taliban and Obama's bellicosity in that part of the world? Is that having any effect in India?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Among certain sections, who now no longer do they see American imperialism as a detriment to the planet as a whole. Certain sections who perhaps might have wanted India to be a little tougher now feel that America is carrying that water and there is no need to be tough on Pakistan. Let the Americans do it. You know, that George Bush coddled the military, and it appears that Obama is not. So the Obama factor has actually not been written about or given as much consideration as it should be. That in many ways it has taken the wind out of the sails both of the right and the left. The right, which wants to attack Pakistan, now people can say, well, look, let the Americans do it. And the left, which wants the question of U.S. and Indian ties to be at the center, well, people say, you know, come on, it's not the America of George Bush anymore, it's the America of Obama. So in that sense, I think we need to consider the role that Obama has played as well from afar in this election.
And in the last few minutes we've got here, the Indian economy is, at least until this current crisis, was regarded as a great success story in many circles and around the world. The India shining myth, the growth of high-tech sectors, and to a lesser extent, basic manufacturing. What is the reality of that? How far has that spread into the Indian population?
Well, it depends always, right, how you define economy. If you define economy by the conventional indicators, India is doing great. There's a growth rate even this year. The World Bank projects somewhere between 5% and 6%, which is much better than -0.25%. It's apparent that industrial growth is going to continue. On all those conventional neoclassical indicators, India seems to have done super in the last 15 years. But if you look at another statistic, you know, India has about a billion people, living in India. It's about the same population as Africa. All of Africa is about a billion. It's surprising that on social indicators, Indian population has worse social indicators than African social indicators. And yet, you know, we have this sort of assumption about Africa being in a kind of spiral of poverty on things like infant mortality, on those questions. India suffers when compared with the totality of Africa. So yes, there has been growth, but it's that typical growth of this era, which is highly unequal, and there seems to be no possibility of bridging that inequality except by these small social democratic measures of giving 100 days of work and things like that. There is no platform of how to take the benefits of growth to the population at large.
And, of course, the left, like the left in many places of the world, India has several communist parties that really none of which have any kind of transformative vision that they've thought about or can articulate. Is that true?
Yes, you know, it is true that in none of the parties, neither the Maoists nor the communists, etc., have been able to articulate a compelling vision of the future. And, you know, as you know, very few places in the world are we able to find that compelling vision. I mean, people are holding on to Venezuela, others are even pointing to China, you know, or wherever. But really, there is a emptiness in our political horizon. We know what we are against, but I'm not sure who knows what we are for.
That was Vijay Prashad, professor of South Asian history at Trinity College in Connecticut. He's got an article on the Indian elections on the Counterpunch website that's well worth looking up, counterpunch.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. If you pledged during our recent fund drive, especially if you did so during Behind the News, thank you very much, and don't forget to pay your pledge if you haven't done so already. Okay, a musical break. is a bit of Bela Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. Bartok, lying in a hospital bed in New York because of a leukemia that would eventually kill him, was so annoyed by how often he heard Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony on the radio rather than his own music, which he considered far superior, wrote that little parody into his most famous piece, the Concerto for Orchestra. Of course, as Judith Butler would remind us, to do parody, you have to inhabit the space of your target. But enough theory. Now it's time to get a little geeky. My next guest is David Skeel, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School who specializes in bankruptcy. He thinks that the bankruptcy code might be a better way to handle troubled financial institutions the way we've been doing it, which is throwing trillions of dollars at them. I'm not sure if I agree, but if we want to get out of this mess and prevent a recurrence, it's worth listening to lots of opinions. Sometimes they're a bit arcane for radio, but sometimes it would behoove people on the left to get down and dirty with the details, which they don't always do. David Skeel. Welcome, David. What is your impression of this gigantic financial bailout so far?
Well, I have not been especially happy with the way it's been handled. The general pattern has been when particularly with the big financial institutions that have gotten into trouble, the pattern has been throw lots of money at them and then stop and decide whether that made sense later. And so I've not been especially happy with the way it's been handled so far, and I'm not entirely thrilled with the proposals for how to reform the regulation going forward.
So you've got an idea on how the bankruptcy code might enter into this. Now, the usual line is that bankruptcy moves too slowly, the financial markets are too fast, and bankruptcy is just not the appropriate tool. You've got a different idea.
I really do have a different idea. I think that the idea that bankruptcy is really slow and it takes years and years to work your way through a bankruptcy case is simply wrong as a description of how bankruptcy works now. Bankruptcy actually is very fast in many cases, and we're seeing that in ways both good and bad with the Chrysler bankruptcy, and we saw it earlier with the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. I generally think bankruptcy can handle most of these big failures, and to the extent there are problems with bankruptcy, I believe that there are some ways we can do fairly small tinkering to make it work in a much better way than simply throwing money at these institutions.
You've also got an idea about how you can use bankruptcy as kind of a gun to the head of the participants. Tell us about that.
Right. One of the proposals that I put forward, and this is one that was initially the idea of Lee Bookite, who is a lawyer in New York and a friend of mine, is to provide for an interim period. And the intuition behind this proposal is that everybody seems to think the only two options are either bail a big institution out or just let them collapse into bankruptcy. It seems to us that you could provide for an interim period where you decided whether bankruptcy was necessary or not. And so our idea is that with a large, systemically important financial institution, what we can do, and we'd need to do some legislation to make this possible, is provide for a 60 to 90 day period where creditors would have to stop. They wouldn't be able to cancel their contracts or try to collect from the institution. And the institution could try to find either a buyer or someone that would be willing to lend money to it to work its way out of its problems. And if at the end of the 60 to 90 day period there wasn't more money forthcoming or there wasn't a buyer for the institution, then it would go into an orderly bankruptcy process.
Now, just a point I think might be important to make. A lot of people think bankruptcy means the end of the line. It's corporate death. That's really not true, right?
It really is not true. This is perhaps the greatest misconception about bankruptcy. Our bankruptcy system is designed to reorganize, to keep the company in business, to preserve business as usual while you're in bankruptcy. And if there's any way to reorganize it and to send it back out into the world, the bankruptcy system is designed to do that. So the idea that bankruptcy equals death is a real misconception about our bankruptcy system.
And this is somewhat unusual in the world, right? Other countries don't do it this way?
It absolutely is unusual in the world. In the last 10 or 15 years, a number of countries have adopted approaches that look like our Chapter 11 reorganization. So it's not quite as unusual as it used to be, but it's still rare to have all of the components that we have, to have a system where managers continue to run the business, Creditors are stopped from collecting, where it's surprisingly easy to borrow money while you're in bankruptcy. Very few countries have a system that has all of these things, which together make it very easy comparatively to save a company that has enough value to be worth saving.
Where the underlying business is good is just that they've got too much debt is what it boils down to, right?
Absolutely. And the term we tend to use is whether this is a viable company or not. If there's a viable business there, our system is designed to preserve that business, to solve some of the problems that led the company into financial distress, and to reorganize it and send it back out.
All right, now let's take us back to the subject at hand. This 60 to 90-day period, is that enough if, or is that too long a time if you've got, say, complicated derivatives contracts where the counterparties might get expected to be paid off in a week or in a day or two?
Well, the response is often that's too long a period of time. Most people would not say that it's too short, and particularly when you're dealing with financial institutions where contracts are very, very time sensitive. I don't believe that the problems with delaying that long are nearly as serious as critics are likely to suggest. Where there is a derivative contract that somebody is using to hedge a risk of some sort, they can go out and get another contract if it's that important. And in some respects, even more importantly, if you have a system like this to look forward to, if your counterparty, if the financial institution may run into problems, it may discourage you as somebody dealing with this institution from putting too many eggs in one basket. One of the big problems with the financial institutions that have run into trouble in the last year, the AIGs and the Bear Stearns and the Lehman Brothers, is that they were a few of a small number of institutions that dominated the derivatives business. If you have a system where if a financial institution runs into trouble, there is going to be this period where you have to wait for 60 to 90 days, you might be a little bit more careful about how much of your derivatives business you give them. And I think actually over the long haul, that's the direction we want to head in. And so another way to put this is, first of all, I think counterparties can go out and enter into new derivatives during the 60 to 90 day period if they're worried about the derivative with the troubled institution. Second of all, one beneficial effect of this proposal is it would be likely to encourage counterparties to deal with more different institutions, not to rely so much on a small number of institutions.
In other words, it would be a problem, but not a real system breaker.
That's exactly right.
All right, this is going to get a little bit arcane for radio, but let me just dispense with this. And
if we haven't gotten arcane already.
This is really going to enter a new level of arcane. But I heard this suggestion at the Council on Foreign Relations the other week. Someone from BlackRock, whose name now escapes me, suggested that we, in the future, treat trading counterparties, differently from creditors. So, people who are caught up with trades with Bear Stearns would be treated differently from the creditors of Bear Stearns. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I would have to know what he means by treated differently.
Subordinated, treated, that'd have to go to the back of the line. The creditors would take prominence over the counterparties.
That's interesting. That is, as I'm sure you're well aware, the exact opposite, in a sense, of what we have now. Under the ordinary bankruptcy rules, derivatives get special treatment in a number of different ways, including they don't have to stop trying to collect. They can cancel their contracts if they want. So in a sense, this would not only be eliminating their special treatment, but it would be treating them worse. I personally don't think that that's necessary. I do think it's necessary to remove some of their special protections. One of the things that a derivatives counterparty can do when an institution files for bankruptcy, and the example here would be Lehman Brothers, is they can cancel their contract. They can take whatever collateral they have. I think with systemically important big institutions, that's a bad idea. So I would be sympathetic to treating derivatives more like other creditors. I don't think it's necessary to treat them worse than other creditors.
His rationale was, he suggested to do this in the future, and his rationale was that the counterparties would demand collateral and be more cautious in the future.
I think that's right, and I think we really do need to think about what effect our regulatory changes are going to have on future behavior. One of the things that clearly has happened in the last few years is we've let this market go. We've left it basically unregulated. We've exempted it from the securities laws in most respects. We've exempted it from bankruptcy. Those exemptions have caused problems. In my view, in focusing on bankruptcy in particular, as I just said, we should reverse some of that special treatment. I don't think it's necessary to push them to the back of the line. If you require derivatives counterparties to be treated like ordinary creditors, to wait, for instance, for this 16 to 90 day period that Bookite and I talk about, that in itself will be enough of a stick to encourage them to monitor, to be careful about who their counterparty is, and to take enough collateral. I don't think you need to push them back further than that.
I was speaking with David Skeel of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Okay, back somewhat from the arcane realm.
That is getting pretty arcane for radio.
How, say, for example, how would you have handled the AIG disaster? Give us an example of how it would work in the world that you're imagining.
You could think of it either in terms of bankruptcy under the existing rules that we have, or under the proposal that Bookite and I have floated. The first thing that I would do if I were Treasury Secretary or were in the middle of this is I would make clear that we're not simply going to bail out any big institution that gets into trouble. And the first effect of that is it would force these companies to think about bankruptcy in advance rather than deliberately failing to plan for failure, which is what AIG did. It's what Lehman Brothers did. It's actually what the car companies did too. So the first thing I think you need to do is send a signal that we're not going to bail everybody out. The second thing you do is when AIG comes along, you at least consider letting them file for bankruptcy. And I think this would be made much easier under the 60 to 90 day proposal that Bookite and I have proposed. I think you assume that is going to be the mechanism for resolving the financial distress. Now, if you reach the conclusion that during that 60 to 90 days the financial world is going to come to an end, which is what AIG was telling regulators, the government could step in. They could protect the counterparties to AIG's derivatives, for instance. Or another concern people had about AIG is that if AIG filed for bankruptcy, there would be a run on its insurance business, that all of its insurance customers would cancel their policies. The government could step in to protect that if they decided that truly was a legitimate concern. I have some questions about that, but one could reach that conclusion. The bottom line would be, rather than pumping money into the troubled institution, we would assume that we're going to use this interim process, possibly leading towards bankruptcy, and intervene, if we intervene, only on the edges, and preferably not with the institution itself, preferably protecting people who are exposed by the institution.
This is essentially a market-based solution with public oversight.
I think that's a great way of describing it. It is a market-based solution with public oversight. And I think the public oversight is important. But the problem with making it entirely a public solution, which is what the Obama administration proposal calls for. What it calls for is giving bank regulators the ability to step in and take control of a troubled non-bank financial institution. The problem with that, in my view, is effectively what you're doing is institutionalizing bailouts. You're giving them, make, making it easier for them to bail out these big institutions. And I don't think that's what we want to do when they run into trouble. And I also don't think we want to be sending these institutions the signal that we're going to be there to pick up the pieces if they misbehave.
All right, let's shift to what Wall Street calls the real sector, the Chrysler bankruptcy. There's a lot of complaints from the creditor community, as I say, that the Obama administration really stepped on the bondholders' toes. What do you think of this?
Well, in Chrysler, I agree with the creditors as much as it pains me to do that. I am no fan of hedge funds. And in Chrysler, it is the hedge funds who are the dissident creditors. I really feel that in Chrysler, what the government has done is crammed down its preferred proposal on everybody else in a way that's really not consistent with the bankruptcy law. So I feel in Chrysler that the government has adopted an ends justify the means strategy. They've concluded that the best result is a combination with fiat and providing a large chunk of the stock of the new Chrysler for the employees of Chrysler. They've concluded that's the right result, but they've really trampled on the bankruptcy process to get there by what they've done is they've constructed what I refer to as a sham sale of Chrysler's assets to a new entity. In GM, on the other hand, I'm more comfortable with what the government's doing. In GM, the government is beating on the bondholders, trying to get them to take a relatively low settlement for what they're owed. I think that so far the government hasn't done anything wrong. They've acted the way a debtor like GM itself would act in a normal case. They can't do a lot of the things that they want to do. Most importantly, force the bondholders to take this low payout without filing for bankruptcy. So we're likely to see a bankruptcy. But so far, I'm less worried about what the government is doing with the bondholders in GM than I am about what the government has done with the dissident senior lenders in Chrysler.
Now, what about the argument that by kicking the creditors to the curb, the Obama administration is preserving a large number of jobs, sparing a lot of communities in Ohio and Michigan severe damage, and preserving our infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, and the creditors can just suck it up?
Well, that is a plausible response. I guess I have a couple of concerns about that. One is, it is clear that these companies are going to need to be majorly restructured, and it may be we get less restructuring than we would get otherwise if we ignore or run roughshod over the bankruptcy process. So that would be one response. The other one is that there are ways to help employees outside of the bankruptcy process. You don't need to force down a sale that doesn't really square with the bankruptcy laws to do that. The government could step in for the employees. It could, for instance, guarantee the retirement funds. This is something people have floated in the past, that maybe we ought to make them effectively a first priority creditor, which is not what they are now. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not thrilled with the way the government is going about trying to save these jobs, and I have a couple concerns about this. One concern is creditors obviously are going to think twice about who they lend to in a world where there's a possibility that what they think they're entitled to, they're not going to get. I'm a little bit, but not a lot, concerned about that. What I'm more concerned about is that what's been done in Chrysler may be an invitation for companies themselves to do the same thing in the future. I'm concerned that 5 years from now, a company can, a debtor that files for bankruptcy, where we're not worried about saving thousands of jobs, and it's really just the debtor's managers who are worried about saving themselves, can conduct a sham sale of the sort that's been conducted in Chrysler and get away with it, because this has provided a precedent for doing that sort of thing. So I guess my bottom line on all of this is the ends that the government is pursuing here in many respects are perfectly laudable and maybe the best ends, but the means worry me a lot. I think there could be some serious collateral damage down the road.
And finally, I know you're a lawyer and specializes in financial issues, but in your judgment, are these going concerns, are GM and Chrysler viable concerns?
I think they are. There's been a lot of speculation that maybe Chrysler is not at the end of the day, and I suppose I don't know enough about the car industry to give a bottom line about that, on that. But my sense is that there are viable going concerns with each of these companies, and that it's worth rescuing them. And I also believe that if we had just used an ordinary bankruptcy process, that's where we would end up. It seems clear that the restructuring that they're in the middle of is necessary. It was unavoidable, but I do think there are viable businesses there, and I think they're businesses that are important to this country.
Well, let's hope you're right. Thanks, David Skill.
It's my pleasure.
That was David Skill of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. I'm a little skeptical of his concern that stepping on the creditors' toes at Chrysler might make them less willing to lend in the future. Market participants have no memory. They lend to countries that default over and over again and again. They take risks that experience of even a few years ago should have warned them against. If the government started in a program of systematic expropriation, that might be different. But this government sure isn't going to do that. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this from Metric, Patriarch on a Vespa. I'm getting so soft in my old age. Metric. Till next week. Bye.